I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's so extraordinarily strange and awesome to see people in a room at a Writers Festival. It's fantastic to be here with you tonight. My name is Michaela Kolofsky. I'm an interviewer and facilitator, and it's my pleasure, I think is the right word, to be running this session, which is Writing the Unspeakable. The other thing I want to do first off, though, is I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of a land that we're on this afternoon, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. People find it almost impossible to talk about some things in Australia, things like depression, grief, suicide, postnatal depression, and there are lots of reasons for that. But these three writers have taken those topics and many more, like toxic masculinity and what it means to be a mum or a woman, and they've written about them in frank and sometimes brutally honest ways. Fiona O'Loughlin, who I'm going to tell you about her in a moment, who's at the end of our panel, has written with extraordinary humour and insight, taking you right into the heart of what it means to be an addict. Ash Davenport has written this extraordinary book, which is so funny. It's almost absurd in its funniness and so honest about what it's like to have your life upended by depression when you've had children. And Lek Blaine, who's written this, he gives shape to an unimaginable tragedy in a way that is so lean and so powerful and so succinct. So let me tell you a little bit more about the three of them before we get going. Fiona O'Loughlin, at the far end of the panel, is Australian comedy royalty. And you don't get to say that very often, so I'm just going to say it again. She's Australian comedy royalty. She's had an award-winning comedy career spanning 20 years. She has performed to packed houses all over the world, including the comedy club, the Improv Comedy Club in LA, UK's Leicester Comedy Festival, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, the Adelaide Fringe, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. But as well as being a critically acclaimed comedian, she's also the author of a book called Me of the Never Never from 2011, and her most recent book that we're talking about today, Truths from an Unreliable Witness, Finding Laughter in the Darkness of Places, in which she details her lifelong experience with alcohol and other addiction. Lek Blaine, who's right next to me, is an award-winning journalist and writer who's from country Queensland. His first book we're talking about today is called Car Crash, a Memoir. It's about friendship, family, grief, trauma, death, and love. His work has also been published in a range of places, including The Best Australian Essays, Kill Your Darlings, The Griffith Review, The Guardian, and The Monthly. And Ash Davenport is a writer from Melbourne. Her book is Sad Mum Lady. It's a collection of essays about early parenthood, postnatal depression, and suicidal thoughts, and also finding a dead rat in the cubby house. Her debut book began as a personal blog called Sad Pregnant Lady. And the book that she's written now is a savage and hilarious and deeply relatable look at motherhood and depression, and it resists the happier-than-thou and acceptable face of parenting. So I want to start at the sort of the head of this topic, which is to ask you each about this idea of writing about topics that are taboo. And I wanted to maybe, Lek, I'll start with you. Why are these topics like depression and grief and tragedy so unspeakable? Why are they taboo? Why do they make people so uncomfortable?
Well, there's all these generational issues around the shame that we carry, both in our bodies, in our thoughts, and in our subconscious, but then just socially as well, in terms of I grew up in country Queensland. I grew up in a pub. My parents were publicans. And so it's quite strange we talk about unspeakable subjects, because socially a lot of these issues would never get talked about, but it wasn't completely unspeakable. A lot of the things that people would talk about wouldn't get spoken about until the 10th or 11th beer. So that was like the threshold that these conversations would usually happen at, and a lot of the time they weren't being conducted with complete civility or vulnerability. It was maybe coming from a place of rage or a place of anger. So it's not that it's never been spoken about, it's just that it's never been normalised in a way that is healthy, or in a way that people feel like they're actually getting a productive handle on whatever it is that they're going through.
Ash, what can you add to that about why these things are make people so uncomfortable, why people are so frightened of talking about them?
The depth of that silence, though, like going back through the years, I had this incredible insight from my mum, who's here tonight. Hi, mum. actually, it's really a terrible story, but she was at a family wake as a young woman, a schoolgirl, and was wearing her school dress, and a family member put his hand up her dress, and the whole room of people saw it happen, and mum's legs like clamped the hand there out of just like responsive kind of this muscle reaction. And so his hand was stuck there, and people all kind of noticed, and they all looked away. They all just looked away, and the silence remained, and then slowly it filled again. But that's in country Victoria, like in the early 60s, and it's right in front of in a room of people, and we are not looking at that situation. The mind boggles. Mm.
Fiona, what is it about, particularly about addiction, but all these topics, grief and death and depression, but addiction in particular, because you write so powerfully about it. Why is it something that we, you know, it's so rife in our society, yet we almost don't have language for it?
Yeah, it's crazy to me. I the more I know, the less I know about, I mean, 1 in 10 of us will, 1 in 10 of all drinkers at some point, that will be ruinous to them. The gateway, it's a gateway drug, alcohol, that's certainly my gateway drug. And it's too close, I think. We're a mirror. It's extraordinary to me, and it keeps blowing my mind, even post-book. I can see, you know, do you mind if I tell you an anecdote?
Please.
I can see now the same DNA. You know, I'm Irish, and there's in every family, I've got 40 cousins, about 6 families of cousins on my dad's side. There's an alcoholic in every family. There's always has been, always will be. And on a, there's always been this 1 in 10 of us as well. That number never changes. And yet, what we choose to believe, it's always there's just something wrong with that one of ours, that 1 in 10, and roll around in the mud of the behaviours of that one when they were drunk. And it's like, well, that was just, you know, it's very frustrating to me. I see 3 nephews, 2 gamblers and 1 drinker. And for me to bring that up, I've written a bloody book about mine. I can see 3. It's what I do. I see you. I can see it. And I spoke to my dad, and he said, no, I was talking about one. He said, no, he's a good boy. I'm like, it has nothing to do. It's not a moral thing. And I think you can't, it's so hard to smash that idea, because my own family saw me dead in a bed, as close to dead as you can get at the, can't remember the name of the hospital, but in Melbourne. And yet 3 years later, when I'm alive and live to tell the tale, it's so frustrating living to tell the tale when you can't even be heard in your own family. Mm.
Like, when, you know, from what we're all talking about, and you said it very well, that it's not that we don't have the conversation, but we don't have it in a way that normalizes the things we're talking about. How did you then approach finding the language to write about what happened to you, and then also all the other things in your life that you write about in the book? Because you also write about toxic masculinity, and you write about the, you know, the pressure to fit in, and you write about male friendship. What did you have to sort of break apart in order to write the book you did?
Well, the story was there. It was based on experiences that I'd had, and it was very, like, they were all very vivid to me. But when I first started writing, I would try and fictionalize those experiences, and then I would write about all the least interesting things about me, which is just like so I was cutting out the car crash that I was in. I was cutting out my parents. I was cutting out my siblings. I was cutting out some of the vulnerable things about the nature of my relationships with people in terms of like stuff like sex. So it was all those usual shames, but that's generally where the like magic happens. That's what other people connect with, and that's what gives them feelings of catharsis, or just the simple feeling of being recognised and being seen, and having someone reflecting their experience back at them.
Ash, you know, in all of these books, all three of you write very personally about your families as well. And I wondered if
I just shared a very personal story about Mum.
You did, but I'm hoping she's okay with that.
She's okay with it.
She's okay. She seems okay. But, you know, you all write with a lot of detail about the nuances of your family, you know, of separation, of divorce, and of, you know, rage, all kinds of things that happened. And I wondered, you know, whether you felt the need to sort of, you know, we're talking about it, conversations around things that are where there's a lot of silence, your own response in particular to becoming a mother and to your own depression and self-loathing. Did you sort of have to clear that with the people around you in order to write about it?
I sent them all their stories, the stories that they were featured in, before it went to the publisher, and I got everyone's okay with that. But the reason I wrote the blog to begin with was out of absolute necessity. I was so lonely in my sadness. It was a cocoon. It was just me in there, and the internet was a way to express that and still feel safe. I could be ugly. I could be angry. I still tried to make it very cute in a list and tie a fucking bow on it. Which I think I got a bit more real by the time I got to the book, but it allowed me to actually literally connect with people on the internet who could say, I see you, I hear you. And I needed that to get through the day, to stay alive. It sounds dramatic, but I did.
Yeah. Fiona, you know, in your book, you traverse a lot of stuff, but particularly looking at addiction, and as you said before, you look at your own family now and you can see a real pattern of addiction. All of you, in order to break apart these things in your life, to try and understand them, all of you return to childhood. You return to childhood memories. And I wondered, Fiona, if there were, when you were writing the book, if there were things that came to light for you that you hadn't noticed before as you were writing the book, where you went, oh, that explains something.
No, I wish I'd... Well, it doesn't matter really. I guess I'll write a third book now. I keep going, oh, damn! Why didn't I write that? But I've had an extraordinary thing happen post-book, and that's get diagnosed with ADHD. Now everything makes sense.
Why? Tell us about that.
Well, I understand now that I couldn't... I never understood why my childhood was so bleak to me, because my circumstances weren't particularly bleak. I don't think our needs were met, anyone of my vintage, in big Catholic families. I think there were too many kids and too much booze.
How many kids were there in your family?
Seven. We were a small family. You have cousins up the road with nine and cousins next town with 12. Yeah. We were hardly trying. But I felt braver in the book. You did that. I thank God for books, because, and yet I've still not been heard through the book.
By your family?
Yeah, I said to my mother, God, she's hilarious. I said, Mum, is there anything, this was 3 months after the book was published, I said, is there anything, you know, that's upset you or you want to talk about that's in the book? She said, of course there's nothing that's upset me in the book. I haven't bloody read the book and I don't intend to.
My dad hasn't read mine.
They're very funny, aren't they, the way they... And I gave it to one of my sisters, the manuscripts, and she brought it back and had nothing to say till I asked her. I wish I hadn't asked her. She said, it's horrifying. One of the most difficult, very challenging read. I said, try living it.
You do get unpredictable reactions from family members. So I had a scene in the book where just after the 2007 election, and I went to Sizzler with my dad, who was a local Labor Party member, and my brother, who was a massive John Howard fan. And so I wrote this scene, and my brother basically berated me, and he said, you know, because Dad was celebrating, and my brother said, Kevin Rudd's going to fuck this country. And he said, it's going to be people with real jobs like me who are paying for all the damage while smug pricks like you are jerking each other off at university, which was such a perfect lie. But I thought I better call him and tell him that I'm going to put it in there. And so I called him and I read this quote to him. Like, I was quite nervous because he's a very lovable guy, but can be quite emotionally volatile, as proven by the quote. And I read it to him, and there was this long silence. And he said, "Mate, that's absolutely brilliant." He's like, "That's exactly what I said, and that's exactly what happened." And so he was chuffed about it. Like, yeah, you can get so worried about depicting people badly, but sometimes they actually want to be depicted. You're actually representing what they actually think, and they're not ashamed of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they see themselves literally on the page.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, see, I wrote my dad into the book in a way that I thought he would like.
Yeah, it's disappointing, isn't it?
And I gave him his copy. He came and there was a letter in the front cover. He's sitting on the couch chatting, then he's got to go. I see him backing down the driveway, and underneath the couch, sticking out a little bit, is the book. And my reaction was not to just be like, "Oh, fuck you, Dad, get it?" Running down the driveway, it's raining. I'm like, Daddy! Like, it was ridiculous. And he's like, gets it. "Oh, yeah, sorry." And then, like, I've since realised that was the working title for the book. Daddy? Question mark?
Yeah.
No, not really. It's fine. But he, I know he's, I know he is scared. He's fucking scared.
There's so much fear. Isn't
it's okay. There? Like, I forgive him.
I'm sick of forgiving.
Yeah, it's boring.
Now we'll get into the crux of it. But, you know, Fiona is a mother of five, and there's a lot in your book, Fiona, about how mothers are supposed to behave, you know, and how addicts are supposed to behave. And, you know, and there's the same in Ash's book about, you know, the gratitude you're supposed to feel, the peace you're supposed to feel, and you both kind of turn that on its head. But what I found surprising both in Lex's book and in Ash's book is that you write about your fathers a lot more than you write about your mothers, that there seems to be something very important about a father's love and a father's kind of continuity in your lives. And I wondered, Lek, if you could talk a bit about that, because you're also your father's, some of the comedy gold in the book comes out of your father's mouth. It's a funny book as well as being a very sad book in a lot of ways.
It wasn't like, a conscious or even subconscious decision. It was just that he was like, he's great material. And so everything that would come out of his mouth would generally be either extremely funny or in some way like insightful, and not always in positive, like completely positive ways. And so he was very honest, and he was very blunt, and he was just very quotable. And I actually had to, when I was going back through the book and through the rewriting, I'd just completely, I'd really neglected my mum in the story. And that was partly due to the fact that she wasn't as quotable and she wasn't as dramatic as my dad. But it was to do with certain feelings of shame about her alcoholism and mental health issues, and I needed to actually peel that back and like present the reality of her. And in writing it, and I wasn't doing it for this purpose, but in writing it, I was actually navigating the reality of who she was before the onset of her various health issues, and that was this like really warm, and also in the finish, I think. That one of the things that I was most happy about was that, Dad, like the general response is that Dad was a standout character in the book, but there's still people who really recognised Mum and saw her, and that she was just as unique and sort of like worthy of literature as my dad. She was just a lot quieter and less over the top. But I think that there's probably, it depends on the family dynamics, but there probably is something that is a little bit more attention grabbing about most people's fathers. It just but it depends on the family and it depends on the dynamics. And
Mum got a pretty attention grabbing chapter.
She did.
She's Mum. Are we doing this? Am I just telling them everything about you? She slept naked, and. She still does. It's fine. We all do. It's fine. We were like a naked house.
But I bath naked.
Yeah. Yeah. There we go. Not with the turtleneck on. Okay. So, and we would have friends over. I'm one of four girls. We had like busy social lives. There were always sleepovers going on. And mum was just like strung out, doing it all alone, like no money, fucking, it was stressful. And she would lose it when there was noise after a certain time. And she'd fire a warning shot from the bedroom, which was either enough or just a scream. And then shortly after that, if it kept going, she would thump down the short distance between her room and ours and pretty much kick down the door, not quite, but it burst through the door, nude and so livid, like screaming rage, totally naked. And every one of my friends from that time has the very clear, vivid memory of that. So you were great content, Mum. You were really good content. She has like a great arc, actually, because I'm so much closer to Mum in my life than I am with Dad, just in a more consistent way. So I'm really able to see her and understand her triumph, really. And Dad's still quite mysterious to me, so maybe that's why he got the last word in the book, but yeah.
Fiona, if how we talk about things has a direct impact on how we understand them, how does writing about this change it? How does writing about the things you've written about help to change the conversation, do you think?
I think what was important to me when I wrote this was, I mean, I was so exhausted with all the relapsing that went on. When I read it 4 months after it was published, I was going, stop, no, don't. It was like my heart was in my throat.
I did get three quarters of the way through the book. And for people who haven't read the book, I'm not ruining anything. Like 95% of the book is relapse and then a relapse and then a relapse and a relapse. And I said to Fiona before this event, it's almost like she's walking you through what it's like to be an addict. There is no
so
glorious
exhausting.
Rainbow moment where you get too tired of taking drugs or alcohol again. But you took us into that experience and you made it real, I feel like, for the reader, because it's unrelenting.
Yeah, it is unrelenting. It's an unrelenting way to live, you know. It's a very exhausting thing to be an addict. Just talking about parents. My dad, I've had no feedback. I dedicated this to my parents. I was really having a crack there. But mum's in the book more than my dad. I guess she's the louder parent. Dad's a background guy, you know. In my stand-up, I say he turns up and parks the car. But he also, I never forget, he rang me about 10 years ago. You know how some dads aren't the phone call people? Then Dad rang me. I was living in Alice Springs about 10 years ago. I've never forgotten it. My husband came out the backyard. He said, Fiona, your dad's on the phone. I'm like, oh, Mum's dead. Like, I thought, why else? I said, why else would he's never God. Rung before? She's fine. But it is a scary thing. It's more to write it rather than converse. But, you know, it's like there it is forever. And I hope I will still be, you know, proud of it. There's always more we learn about, you know, addiction. I learned so much. I sat in the front of the class, really, in every... And getting back to the ADHD, it now... And I'm glad I didn't know about that when I wrote this. I feel like now such a high percentage of females my age that went undiagnosed. And I thought ADHD... I used to make jokes about ADHD, you know, think it was just... I didn't really give it any... mind, but it isn't. It's a real challenging brain neurodiversity, and I can literally learn nothing that's told to me. The only way I can learn is through narrative, so it has to have a beginning, middle, and end. So that's why I did school for 13 years, and all I know is I know nothing really. I know. Osmosis is the diffusion of fluid through a semi-permeable membrane. And 6/8 of 48. That's it.
that might be all we need to know right now.
But English made sense to me, and that was the only subject that I ever passed. Maybe a bit of history. We get very hyper-focused. What I didn't know about Woodrow Wilson wasn't worth knowing. And unfortunately, the exam question was the French Revolution.
Gosh.
So I just crowbarred in what Woodrow Wilson would have thought had he lived during the French Revolution. You're on your feet your whole life hiding this. And 80% of us turn out to be addicts, so that's extraordinary. Like, so many of us are alcoholic. And I felt for a bit that the diagnosis basically meant nothing's my fault. Mm. After all. Mm-hmm. Felt nice.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I'm coming under more fire from this book than I ever have, you know, with anything, really.
By who?
By my family, by immediate family. Okay. And it's a cold fire. It's a cold war, you know. But it's definitely not been received well. And it's silence. I mean, I've been putting up with silence for a long time because people in my family think that my career, like if we talk about what she does, it'll encourage her. And they think it's completely linked to addiction. So it's not okay for me to really, I don't talk about what I do. And I thought, I had high hopes for this, you know, that it might crack some heads or skulls, but no.
Yeah.
But it's doing its job for strangers, they're lovely.
Yeah.
Lek, can I put that question to you about what writing does to kind of change both a kind of a bigger conversation, but whether it's changed conversations in your social circle, in your friendship circle, other people who maybe hadn't spoken to you about your own life or your own mental health before?
Yeah, totally. Like, that's not why I necessarily wrote the book.
No.
But, like, in terms of the process of writing the book, I was having conversations with... So I was in a car accident that killed three mates and... two of the other survivors for, you know, the better part of a decade, I hadn't really had like a proper conversation with either of them about the lived experience of grief or trauma. And it was partly through the process of like me writing the book, but also just probably the process of us growing up, that we could actually have those conversations and just exist in each other's company without feeling like survival produces almost like a competitive tension, especially when you're survivors, and so you feel like you're failing by admitting to all of the usual symptoms of whatever you're going through in terms of symptoms of depression or symptoms of PTSD. And so, yeah, it just becomes like it's not a complete kind of silence, because you do still have conversations, but they're very rudimentary and they're not really breaking the surface. And so, yeah, the book became an opportunity, but also life just produces its own opportunities to really just sit there in comfort and be exactly who you are, and that produces these really hard-won moments of connection with people who might not be able to understand exactly what you're going through, but they're pretty close.
Mm. Ash, but you and both Fiona use humour a lot. I know, Fiona, it's your lifeblood. It's kind of just how you're built and how you see the world. But Ash, I wondered, you've got a particular kind of voice in the book. You've got these sections of the book where you reimagine these scenes. You kind of write, they're almost like little mini plays throughout the book, where when you take one of your children to see the early childhood health nurse, and you're just trying to imagine your way out of this very kind of dire, dislocated experience you're having. How did you find that voice?
Well, every time I see that maternal child health nurse, she asks, when's the next baby coming? She's what's happening? You tick-tock, you're going to have another child. She's so full on. And if you can't have fun with her, she will crush you. So especially
just
when...
Just what you want in a maternal health nurse.
Especially yeah. When you're... Are you breastfeeding? And she does these, like, trick questions to, like, test you and things. Like, she's a nightmare.
Right. So you've got her back in the book, really.
Yeah, but yeah. I hate her, but I love her as well. And that was how I was able to survive her, for example. She's kind of an extreme example. But when you're so strung out and tired and your body's...
busted. You've got to create some little world in that situation in order for it to be in like a little bit magic. I needed to escape from a lot of those daily situations in the early days of parenthood, the first 2 years, early days. And that was why I wrote those little bits in. That was me just escaping into myself and having fun. Mm. Yeah.
When I was thinking about this topic, you know, when you think about what's taboo, the counter to that is should. All the things we should be doing, you know, the way we should enjoy things, or the way we should manage being an addict, or the way we should be grateful that we're an international comedy star, all the shoulds that hang over us. And I want to ask you all to reflect on this, but I thought we'd start with Fiona, because you have, you know, now you're all writers and people know your names and they can pick up your book and read your stories, but you've also got this public profile as well. And I wondered if you could talk about how that added to the experience of going through addiction when everybody's watching you, or when you go places and people recognize you. They could see you when you were drunk on the street. They could see you if you were running down the main street without your shoes on. They would tell people, they would tell you. How does that add to what you're going through when you're in that grip of addiction? So under the microscope.
It kind of became, there were so many experiences, you know, incidents, and so many shocking, you know, it's not pretty. Alcoholism is not pretty. I've made such an ass of myself on so many different types of stages, you know, passing out in the Queensland Performing Arts Centre in front of 450 people. God, like, nodded off 20 minutes into my own show, bored myself, God. So it was almost insurmountable amount of places and experiences, and I'm still finding out about them. I went into a country town in South Australia, and I went into the newsagent, Panola, I think it was. You know, I'm just in the newsagent, and the guy goes, "Oh, Gary will be pleased to see you back." I said, "Oh, yes, imagine that."
I love him.
Fuck, he's Gary.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, you know, of course, I missed the train back to Adelaide last time, and Gary drove me back. And
he's so dependable.
It's just so many saviours, you know, and I've flown from state to state in blackout. I remember turning up at the Sydney airport and, excuse me, are we in Perth or Melbourne? And it's too much. There are too many incidents. So I kind of put them all in one box and just cope, because that is me. And I will not shy from the fact that my behaviours whilst drunk were awful, you know, worrying, desperately sad at times, but that I cannot sit and live in that shame. I just can't, or it will kill me, because there's only one thing that really, you know, this is the tricky thing with alcoholism, when you've made such a, you know, I've made a dick of myself in, I reckon I'm the captain of the world of making a dick of myself, and I was born with an innate belief that other people's thoughts can't hurt you. I've always known that. There's some kind of chip missing in me, you know. And really, really grateful too, though, for the kindnesses that came my way that you never forget. For instance, the producer of Spicks and Specs, can never think of his name, but to tell someone you're too drunk to come on the show, it's not easy. You know, I didn't make it easy on people, but I'd never forget the way he was, and it was just kinder than he need have been, and that is helpful. Any kindness that an addict gets over shame and guilt and anger is a bonus. It'll get you there quicker. Yeah.
I was struck by that. There are repeated stories like that in your book of people just small acts of kindness, not even big acts. Okay, there's the driving you across state, which is quite big. But
I remember being at an AA meeting in Melbourne, and this guy came up to me and said, "Oh God, you're in a bad way. Last time I saw you, just take it." Well, yeah, sorry. And he said, "Yeah, I put you in a cab and I went to a 7-Eleven, got you toothpaste and $50, cash and put you in a cab. Anyway, I went to pay him back. He said, I'm kidding, I've never met you before.
Fantastic.
I remember that.
Oh, God, I love
it. Was fantastic. there's a great line that Fiona uses in the book about being, you know, not being ready for rehab until she's ready. And I want to ask you, Lek, about this idea of being ready for recovery, because there's this, a sense in all the books when we're talking about grieving or trauma that the main narrative we're given usually is that it comes to an end. We have some epiphany and someone says the right words to us in the right way and it all just kind of magically lifts. And what becomes clear in all three of these books is that it's unending. And I wondered if you could talk about, because there is an arc in your book to in the story of you kind of coming to understand stuff. Can you talk about how that happened and what was going on for you when you were ready to start recovering or recognizing what was happening to you?
Yeah, well, I never really saw it as a recovery process, because one of the things that going through therapy for depression was that I learned the way that, like you talk about innate being born with stuff, I learned the way that a lot of the things that I was thinking or feeling weren't necessarily like produced by the car accident. Like it wasn't, I didn't need to fix the way that I thought about certain things. That they were just like my personality. Like I had a capacity for great happiness and I had a capacity for great sadness. And it was picking through the things that were like behaviors that I needed to change, and also just learning to live with who I was as like a human being who was, you know, capable of all of these different emotions. And so I never felt like there was going to be a finish line for that. Like that was, it was learning that there wasn't a finish line. It was learning that that it was just living, like there wasn't boxes that I was going to tick along the way. I would just be always grappling with grief, grappling with sadness in different ways. Cause I couldn't change the fact that three people had died. Like that was the grief. It was a completely natural response to those set of circumstances. So there was never going to be a moment where I went, that's over or that's finished, or I've found a sense of closure. And then I didn't need to find closure from that. Like it was okay to feel sadness about that, that very grim reality.
In an open-ended way.
Yeah. And also that would allow me in other parts of my life to feel great happiness, and I would stop like numbing by just numbing everything. I was actually not just stopping the grieving process, but I was also stopping my ability to feel love and happiness and to be just exist in the moment. So it goes both ways.
Yeah. I wrote about that in the book, about having that moment. You just lose the good moments. You can't. I think it was a compliment Lawrence Mooney gave me. Yeah, and I wrote about that in the book at the Spiegel tent. And I thought, God, I've got to get sober so I can feel these wonderful moments, because that's what you miss.
Yeah, I couldn't ask for help. I couldn't say I wasn't coping. It was like there was some force internally that was keeping me silent. And it was, I'd gotten to this place in the story, I was so deep in this web of depression and shame and just loathing, self-loathing, because I wasn't being a good mum. I could cry, because you know, what the fuck, when you're not being a good mum?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, thank God for you, Fiona.
It's, yeah, and then I quickly said it to my partner. It was like there was a crack. And I just like quickly said it, like, I'm not coping. And it had been months of just like suffering and just going further into that despair. And as soon as I said it, that was writing the fucking unspeakable. You say it and then you start to heal. And look, I'm all better now.
Ash said something very beautiful about her book when I asked her why she used the humour she did. And she said it was like taming a monster. She said, now I can make you dance.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to make you funny. Now I'm going to make you somber. And you also said something I'd love you to share, which is that you discovered when you'd finished writing the book that, can you say that? That you,
oh, yeah.
Can you tell? Can you? I thought that really blew me away. It's like a magic spell.
Yeah, so now that monster lives in that book.
Ah.
So, and I...
She's trapped it in the pages of the book.
It's trapped and it's arranged and it's gorgeous, and but it's there. And occasionally I'll hear those old stories. They'll sort of come hissing back from the depths, and it's like I can't really hear it because it's muffled from the cover of the book. So I'm like, it's like, you should fucking kill yourself. But I'm like, so what?
Yeah.
What was that? Yeah, there's something very like powerful about putting it down.
The self-loathing is wonderful to be free of.
Yeah.
Oh, I used to heckle myself before. You can loathe yourself so much. Before I went on stage, I'd be in my own green room talking instantly. Like being an asshole to myself in the mirror.
Just to get it out of the way.
Yeah, I'd be like this. Are you going to tell them that, are you? Yeah. Yeah, why don't you tell them that, you fucking idiot? Yeah, yeah, tell them that one too, you fucking... I'd go out onto a stage with that ringing in my head.
Oh, my God. Like,
it's so cruel what we do.
It's hideous.
Oh, yeah, they'll laugh.
But you talk about cruelty, and what I was quite amazed to read, how kind people, particularly in the comedy world, were.
Yeah.
That you write over and over again people who just displayed no judgment. They just picked you up and cleaned you up and sent you on your way.
Mm.
And they didn't say, you got to get clean or you're going to die. No one particularly said that. Do you feel like there are more people in the comedy industry who are addicts, who are experiencing depression and addiction? That's kind of the vibe I get from the outside. But I was very struck by, I wanted to ask you that question, but I was also very struck by how genuinely collegiate and caring they were.
Yeah, they are. It's a beautiful community, and it's not really fraught with much. What have you got that I have? You know, the competition is... I've never really felt in competition because we're such, you know, no one can do what that... You know, a comedian's only doing their version of comedy, so... I feel that it's my other family. I graft comedians to my heart. Like, I mean, it saved me. I remember once when I was, you know, there's every now and then I'd drink, pretend I wasn't drinking, but be drinking on the sly at comedy festival. And I remember Tom Gleason one night. He's the only normal comic I know. You know, like. I don't know what's wrong with Tom, but he seems, you know, quite happy and well-balanced, so that's a shame. I hope he can work on that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know about addicts, but definitely bruised fruit, you know. A lot of ADHD, I'd say more ADHD, because to be a comedian, you can't be stupid. You don't need to be educated, you know, but being stupid doesn't really... We're the kids that couldn't learn. A lot of us. I'm Akmal and I are almost the same person. Like, except he didn't have to have children and be the mother and the wife, lucky bastard. But I remember Tom Gleason, and he must have noticed. We were just having drinks. I can't remember who else was there, but all of a sudden he kind of just, he said, come on, and he walked me from this bar down to Swanston Street, hailed a cab, put me in it, said, we love you, be safe. You know, it's that kindness and the lack of judgment, I guess, because comedians, you know, live pretty raucous lives, so there's not a whole lot of judgment. Yeah.
Mm. Like, picking up on something Fiona said, that you also found people who helped you in the book, and I wondered if you could talk a bit about Christopher and that experience, because that was hilarious. Can you talk about that and the group of grad students watching you?
Yeah, well, my sister was a psychology student. I was living with her, and she said I'd gotten arrested, and so she said, you know, my dad had said you're going to go see a psychologist, and so he took the option out of my hand. And I was talking to my sister about it, and I said, well, I don't have any money, so I can't pay for it. And she was in a grad program with a professor of psychology at a university, and she went to him and and explained the problem, and he said, I'll do it for free. And so she came back and told me that, and I said, that's awesome. Like, where do I sign up? She said, the only catch is that the session's going to be live streamed to a room full of graduate students down the hall. And I was like, that's fine. Like, I had no hesitation. I was like, as long as it's free, I'll be, yeah, I'm there. And so it was the best thing that I ever did, because it was weekly, these weekly sessions with someone who was like a expert in their field and who'd been doing it for 30 years. And so I got like a first-hand insight into the possibilities of therapy and like the possibilities that could be provided to a whole heap of people who would never be able to afford it otherwise, like who were walking around the streets of Australia every day carrying all of these unspeakable subjects. And yeah, I'd spent this process just speaking all like from start to finish. And one of the best things that he did was he said, don't start with the car crash, we're going to go right back to the very beginning. And so I actually reconstituted my my sense of self around all of these previous experiences, which were then stopping me from actually connecting with my feelings of grief from this accident. And yeah, it was so, it was but you only have the opportunity and the time to do that with in that sort of scenario, because I wasn't paying for it.
Yeah. And Ash, you found a quite a raucous and random group of people. Can you talk about the people you found in that experience? It's very moving in the
book.
You
mean my old ladies in the woods?
Your old ladies in the woods who helped you. Who were they?
So they were, it was an anger management group. And I didn't really know what I was going into, but it was very appealing to me because it was out of Melbourne, like quite a bit out of Melbourne. It was completely, you know, I could just kind of slip in the dead of night and no one knew what I was doing. And I just liked that, just liked the sound of it. I thought it'd be a good story, you know, I'm going out there. And this was before I'd had the confession to my partner. So I was in this place of like deep shame, writing this book, but not really going deep into the pain that I was feeling. It was more coming from a place of like, I'm reacting to how hard parenthood is, and it is really hard. But I went out there and this woman comes out to the, I pull up to this like town hall in the middle of this country town, and this woman comes up, she's like in her 80s, a little knitted beanie and a torch. And I look at her and wind down my window, she's like, are you Ash? I was like, yes. So I follow her in, we'd emailed back and forth, follow her in, and it's this little side room off a hall with three other women who were like 70s and 80s, who had had this lifetime of anger problems that now manifested in their lives as like, you know, not being treated as a friggin' human being, like is what happens at that stage of life. Anyway, it was something about it that was just like, it was very private, it was very safe, it was very weird, it was like I was in a dream. And I was able to say that I was in the thick of it. And I started crying there, and that was really the first time that I cried, actually like just cried and felt what I was feeling and didn't try and like give it a snappy headline and make a blog out of it. You know, it was just like what I was feeling. And they, one of the women just stood up behind me, and she just, I'll never forget the feeling of her hand on my back. Like she didn't fucking hug me. I don't want to hug. Do you want a hug when you're feeling like that? You recoiled at some hugs, didn't you? Do
yeah,
you still?
I wasn't much of a hugger.
I don't want that when I'm really feeling that. So it was this hand, and the hand was just there as long as I needed it to be there. That's what it felt. Because she just kept it there until I turned around and I was like, thank you. And then the hand was gone. But I've just felt so supported by those women. I've got to hit them up. I never went back.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I can see we've got people who are ready to ask questions. This lady's been waiting for a while. Come and ask us a question. Thanks for coming down.
For all of you, a question about your decision to publish. Like when you started writing, did you know you wanted to publish, or it came later? When?
Thank you.
For me, I knew that because it was my second book. with Sasha. So I got the good news in the mail, which is very rare for the first book. It's just a letter from, you know, a publisher saying, I saw you on a, telling a story. If you ever thought of writing a memoir? So it was pretty exciting.
Mm.
What about you?
Yeah, the blog was just the blog. I didn't really have any big book plans, but someone who I know and love and trust his opinion of said after a year or so of me blogging, you should write a book. And my response was, oh great, so I just print out the blogs, right? And I just staple them together. Yeah. And then that's a book. And he was like, no, don't do that.
I do remember though, my sister said when I was living back home in my family home at 52, living with mum and dad, my sister stood in our childhood bedroom and she said, you're going to write your way out of this. So that was, and I did get up and borrow mum's computer and write the actual first 600 words that got me the deal. You know, when I...
I had to write 50,000 to get a... deal, but different stages.
Wonderful question.
Something to look forward to.
Can we hear from Lek as well?
Yeah. I wrote the first chapter without telling anyone else, and then I submitted that for something, and then the book deal sort of came about. So I wasn't really, I hadn't, and then it took me 5 years to finish it. So yeah, it was a pretty convoluted process after the initial thing had sort of been formalised. But yeah, I definitely never thought that I'd write a book about it. Like, it wasn't, yeah, it didn't really seem like...
It wasn't a plan.
No.
Yeah. Come to this question over here. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Sierra, and my question is kind of two parts, and it's kind of related to that one. So first, what is your counsel for people who have... as somebody said... there's all these people walking around with the unspeakable inside of them. So what is your counsel for anyone for how to start that process of writing the unspeakable? So that's part one, how to start the process of writing the unspeakable. And part two, does it matter that you have published this stuff? So how does that, because I think all of you guys are writing in some way in general, but how does the fact that it's published and people are reading it, how does that change it, the experience for you? And I think we kind of talked about this, but if you have anything to add to that.
Thank you.
The main advice is always, and I kept on forgetting it the whole time that I was writing the book, but my editor would keep on reminding me that nobody was going to read every word that I was putting down, and that there was going to be like a process of editing. And so I think that's sometimes the hardest thing, is like appreciating that every single word that you're writing isn't immediately going into the eyeballs of the people that you're most anxious about reading it.
Yeah, just say it. Write it for yourself or tell someone you trust, or just get it out of your head in some way. That was the key. And the book side of things, I don't know, I wish I was braver in the book. I think I was brave enough, but if you can somehow not have the fact that it's going to be in a published book in your mind, if you can get that out, I think the book will be better for it. Because I was sort of pandering to some invisible audience a little bit when I was writing it. And I wish I didn't do that.
Fiona?
Thank you for the question. I guess for me it felt great to have... it not panned. You know, it was really important. I can get over bad review on a stand-up show, but it was just, I was just so relieved that people heard it, you know, sort of, and it did its, you know, it's something. It's adding to whatever's out there. Because I know myself, there's a great book called The Lost Weekend, which I want to get hold of, which talks about what it's like to be inside a relapse. The book's about 50 years old. But yeah, I'm just glad it's there. I wrote this specifically for my children, to explain myself, and for anyone in the throes of not being able to get out of this cycle. So yeah, I'd get a friend and write with her to the answer to that question, or her or him, but somebody else who's got the unspeakable, if you know anybody. Although if you've murdered someone, you will have to go to the police, I'm afraid.
We're almost out of time, and I want to take this last question because you've been waiting so patiently. Thank you.
Oh my God, don't say anything. What are you going to say?
My name's Geordie. I have a specific question for Ash.
Oh my God.
Davenport. So we've spoken a bit today about showing your book to family and friends who may have been featured in it and how they would receive that. What I want to know, Ash, is how you'll approach sharing your book with your daughters who are very young. So would it be something that maybe you'll like wait until they're like, Mum, I'm going to have a kid. You're like, here you go. You need this.
My plan is to have like a stunt book that's completely different. It's called Happy Mum Lady. And instead of the bunny being drowning in the bucket of water, it's just like sitting on a bed, because that's the cover art. And to just get like really, really elaborate with tricking them. No, I'm glad. I'm glad they'll have it. I'm glad they'll have it as a reference. I'm explaining myself as well to them in some way. And I want them to just feel so loved at the end of it. And to have stories, because we forget. Mum tells the same 6 stories from when I was little, and I'm like, yeah, they're good, you know. But to actually get them down, like the, I think it will be valuable to them, hopefully. Thank you, Geordie. I know him.
Okay, we're going to come to one last question over here before we wrap up.
Hi, I'm Anita. I have written down my unspeakable experiences that I have. So my question is, what do I do now? Is it best to find an agent or put it out in the slush pile or what?
Yeah, I guess just to submit it to as many places as possible and throw it out into the world and see what happens.
I put mine on Instagram. I would have like little snippets and little bits and pieces of the overarching idea, and just created this little mini world around this, the topic of motherhood and whatever those main themes were. And then I just said, I was on a banana phone and saying, I'm on a call with my publisher, I'm writing a book. There was no book deal, there was nothing. And I just put it out there, and I'd gained a little bit of a following online, and then somebody wrote to me who was an editor and said they were interested, and that it sort of went from there. But it was a long process, little breadcrumbs out in the universe.
Fiona?
I've no idea. Sorry?
You're Fiona O'Loughlin. It's like, that was your book deal. Like, I feel like...
Don't you know who I am?
I still can't believe that I've been able to be an author. But it's a fun thing.
Yeah. Very fun.
I'll raise you and show you. But, what was I going to say about that? I've forgotten. It said something. No, it's gone. Sorry.
Okay. I want to thank you all very much for supporting Sydney Writers Festival, but I also want to thank these 3 exceptional writers for smashing taboos with these wonderful books. Please thank them.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.